Black Boy, Disc 15.
I attended the next meeting and asked for a place on the agenda, which was readily granted. Nielsen was there. Evans was there. Ed Green was there. When my time came to speak, I rose and said, "Comrades, for the past 2 years I've worked daily with most of you. Despite this, I have for some time found myself in a difficult position in the party. What has caused this difficulty is a long story which I do not care to recite now. It would serve no purpose. But I tell you honestly that I think I've found a solution of my difficulty. I am proposing here tonight that my membership be dropped from the party rolls. No ideological differences impel me to say this. I simply don't wish to be bound any longer by the party's decisions. I would like to retain my membership in those organizations in which the party has influence, and I shall comply with the party's program in those organizations. I hope that my words will be accepted in the spirit in which they are said. Perhaps sometime in the future, I would like to meet and talk with the leaders of the party as to what tasks I can best perform." I sat down amid a profound silence. The Negro secretary of the meeting looked frightened, glancing at Nielsen, Evans, and Ed Green. "Is there any discussion on Comrade Wright's statement?" the secretary asked finally. "I move that discussion on Wright's statement be deferred," Nielsen said. A quick vote confirmed Nielsen's motion. I looked about the silent room, then reached for my hat and rose. "I would like to go now," I said. No one said anything. I walked to the door and out into the night, and a heavy burden seemed to lift from my shoulders. I was free, and I had done it in a decent and forthright manner. I hadn't been bitter. I hadn't raked up a single recrimination. I had attacked no one. I disavowed nothing. I remembered as I walked the night streets how I had stolen money from the movie house in Jackson, Mississippi, how I had forced the window and had stolen the gun, how I had broken into the college storehouse and had stolen cans of fruit preserves. I remembered how I had lied to my boss man in Memphis when I had wanted to leave my job and come to Chicago, how I had lied to Mr. Hoffman, how I had forged notes to the library in Memphis when I had wanted books to read. But I had changed. I had none of that fear, none of those wild impulses now. I had merely confronted my comrades, stated what I felt, and had let it go at that. The Communist Party couldn't say that I was an enemy, that I had attacked them. A Trotskyite, or a man bent upon wrecking or disrupting the work of the Communist Party, would have remained within the organization so as better to quarrel, obstruct. But I had only asked to be free, had accused no one, and had denounced nothing. Perhaps, I told myself, when the Communist Party has grown up, when it can work without tactics of terror, threat, invective, intimidation, suspicion, I would go back. Oh, God, how naive I was. I was young and brimming with confidence. I felt that my strength was unlimited. I had neatly solved a problem that had been worrying me for a long time, and now I thought that I could turn my energies to writing and justify myself. I didn't know that night how little I understood the political party to which I had belonged, but I soon learned how simple were my motives, how trusting was my attitude, how wide and innocent were my eyes, as round and open and dew-wet as morning glories. The next night, two Negro communists called at my home. They pretended to be ignorant of what had happened at the unit meeting. Patiently, I explained what had occurred. "Your story doesn't agree with what Nielsen says," they said, revealing the motive of their visit. "And what does Nielsen say?" I asked. "He says that you are in league with a Trotskyite group, and that you made an appeal for other party members to follow you in leaving the party." "What?" I gasped. That's not true. I asked that my membership be dropped. I raised no political issues. What did this mean? I sat pondering. Look, maybe I ought to make my break with the party clean. If Nielsen's going to act this way, I'll resign. You can't resign, they told me. What do you mean? I demanded. No one can resign from the Communist Party, they said. I looked at them and laughed. You're talking crazy, I said. Nielsen would expel you publicly. Cut the ground from under your feet if you resigned, they said. People would think that something was wrong if someone like you quit here on the South Side. I was angry. Was the party so weak and uncertain of itself that it couldn't accept what I had said at the unit meeting? Who thought up such tactics? Then, suddenly, I understood. These were the secret underground tactics of the political movement of the communists under the czars of old Russia. The Communist Party felt that it had to assassinate me, morally, merely because I didn't want to be bound by its decisions. I saw now that my comrades were acting out a fantasy that had no relation whatever to the reality of their environment. Tell Nielsen that if he fights me, then by God I'll fight him, I said. If he leaves this damn thing where it is, then all right. If he thinks I won't fight him publicly, he's crazy. I wasn't able to know if my statement reached Nielsen, but there was no public outcry against me. But in the ranks of the party itself, a storm broke loose, and I was branded a traitor, an unstable personality, and one whose faith had failed. What a weird experience I'd had. At no time had I felt at home in the Communist Party. I had always felt that the possibility was there, but always I wasn't quite sure of the motives of the people with whom I worked, and they never seemed quite sure of mine. My comrades had known me, my family, my friends. They, God knows, had known my aching poverty. But they had never been able to conquer their fear of the individual way in which I acted and lived, an individuality which life had seared into my blood and bones. I now avoided the comrades as much as possible, and as I was losing touch with the party, many other young Negroes of the South Side were entering it for the first time. The expansion of the party's activity under the People's Front policy offered many opportunities to young Negroes who, because of race and status, had led cramped lives. The invitation to go to Switzerland as a youth delegate, which I had refused, was accepted by a young Negro who had fought the Communist Party and all its ideas until he had seen a chance to take a trip to Europe. I was transferred by the relief authorities from the Southside Boys Club to the Federal Negro Theater to work as a publicity agent. There were days when I was acutely hungry for the incessant analyses that went on among the comrades, but whenever I heard news of the party's inner life, it was of charges and countercharges, reprisals and counter-reprisals. I was glad to be out of it. All its energies, it seemed, were absorbed in factional fights, hair-splitting political definitions. The Federal Negro Theater, for which I was doing publicity, had run a series of ordinary plays, all of which had been revamped to Negro style, with jungle scenes, spirituals, and all. For example, the skinny white woman who directed it, an elderly missionary type, would take a play whose characters were white, whose theme dealt with the Middle Ages, and recast it in terms of Southern Negro life with overtones of African backgrounds. Contemporary plays dealing realistically with Negro life were spurned as being controversial. There were about 40 Negro actors and actresses in the theater, lolling about, yearning, disgruntled, not knowing what to do with themselves. What a waste of talent, I thought. Here was an opportunity for the production of a worthwhile Negro drama, and no one was aware of it. I studied the situation, then laid the matter before white friends of mine who held influential positions in the Works Progress Administration. I asked them to replace the white woman, including her quaint aesthetic notions, with someone who knew the Negro and the theater. They promised me that they would act. Within a month, the white woman director had been transferred. We moved from the South Side to the Loop and were housed in a first-rate theater. I successfully recommended Charles Duchaime, a talented Jew, as director. Duchaime and I held long talks during which I outlined what I thought could be accomplished. I urged that our first offering should be a bill of 3 one-act plays, including Paul Green's Hymn to the Rising Sun, a grim, poetical, powerful one-actor dealing with chain gang conditions in the South. I was happy. At last, I was in a position to make suggestions and have them acted upon. I was convinced that we had a rare chance to build a genuine Negro theater. I convoked a meeting and introduced Duchaime to the Negro company, telling them that he was a man who knew the theater, who would lead them toward serious dramatics. Duchaime made a speech wherein he said that he was not at the theater to direct it, but to help the Negroes to direct it. He spoke so simply and eloquently that they rose and applauded him. I then proudly passed out copies of Paul Green's Hymn to the Rising Sun to all members of the company. Duchaime assigned reading parts. I sat down to enjoy adult Negro dramatics, but something went wrong. The Negroes stammered and faltered in their lines. Finally, they stopped reading altogether. Duchaime looked frightened. One of the Negro actors rose. "Mr. Duchaime," he began, "we think this play is indecent. We don't want to act in a play like this before the American public. I don't think any such conditions exist in the South. I lived in the South, and I never saw any chain gangs. Mr. Duchaime, we want a play that will make the public love us." I could not believe my ears. I had assumed that the heart of the Negro actor was pining for adult expression in the American theater, that he was ashamed of the stereotypes of clowns, mammies, razors, dice, watermelon, and cotton fields. Now they were protesting against dramatic realism. I tried to defend the play, and I was heckled down. "What kind of play do you want?" Duchaime asked them. They didn't know. I went to the office and looked up their records and found that most of them had spent their lives playing cheap vaudeville. I had thought that they played vaudeville because the legitimate theater was barred to them. And now it turned out that they wanted none of the legitimate theater, that they were scared spitless at the prospects of appearing in a play that the public might not like, even though they didn't understand that public and had no way of determining its likes or dislikes. I felt, but only temporarily, that perhaps the whites were right, that Negroes were children and would never grow up. Duchaime informed the company that he would produce any play they liked, and they sat like frightened mice, possessing no words to make known their vague desires. When I arrived at the theater a few mornings later, I was horrified to find that the company had drawn up a petition demanding the ousting of Duchaime. I was asked to sign the petition, and I refused. "Don't you know your friends?" I asked them. They glared at me. I called Duchaime to the theater, and we went into a frantic conference. "What must I do?" he asked. "Take them into your confidence," I said. "Let them know that it is their right to petition for a redress of their grievances." Duchaime thought my advice sound, and accordingly, he assembled the company and told them that they had a right to petition against him if they wanted to, but that he thought any misunderstandings that existed could be settled smoothly. "Who told you that we were getting up a petition?" a black man demanded. Duchaime looked at me and stammered wordlessly. "There's an Uncle Tom in the theater," a black girl yelled. After the meeting, a delegation of Negro men came to my office and took out their pocket knives and flashed them in my face. "You get the hell off this job before we cut your belly button out," they said. I tried to talk to them, but couldn't. That day, a huge, fat black woman, a blues singer, found an excuse to pass me as often as possible, and she hissed under her breath in a menacing sing-song, "Lord, I sure hates a white man's nigger." I telephoned my white friends in the Works Progress Administration. "Transfer me at once to another job or I'll be murdered." Within 24 hours, DeShime and I were given our papers. We shook hands and went our separate ways. I was transferred to a white experimental theatrical company as a publicity agent, and I resolved to keep my ideas to myself, or better, to write them down and not attempt to translate them into reality. I dodged the Negro theatrical world and kept rigorously clear of all members of the Communist Party. Whenever I met any of my erstwhile comrades, they refused to acknowledge my existence in accordance with a party principle that made it imperative that all traitors be isolated from the working class. One evening, a group of Negro communists called at my home and asked to speak to me in strict secrecy. I took them into my room and locked the door. "Dick," they began abruptly, "the party wants you to attend a meeting Sunday." "Why?" I asked. "I'm no longer a member." "That's all right. They want you to be present," they said. "Communists don't speak to me on the street," I said. "Now, why do you want me at a meeting?" They hedged. They didn't want to tell me. "If you can't tell me, then I can't come," I said. They whispered among themselves and finally decided to take me into their confidence. "Dick, Ross is going to be tried," they said. "For what?" They recited a long list of political offenses, of which they alleged that he was guilty. "But what has this got to do with me?" "If you come, you'll find out," they said. "I'm not that naive," I said, smiling. I was suspicious now. Were they trying to lure me to a trial and expel me? This trial might turn out to be mine. They swore that they had no intention of placing me on trial, that the party merely wanted me to observe Ross's trial so that I might learn what happened to enemies of the working class. "But I'm not your enemy," I said. "We want to save you," they said. "Save me from what?" I asked. "I'm not lost." "We have your welfare at heart," they said. "Then why did you all lie and call me a Trotskyite?" "Nielsen lost his head," they said. "When you left the party, he had to hit at you some way." "Why do you spend your time in these crazy witch hunts?" I asked them. "You claim to be fighting oppression, but you spend more of your time fighting each other than in fighting your avowed enemies." As I spoke to them, I recalled the time when my mother had slapped me, when I had asked her, in the far-off days of Arkansas, why my uncle had run away from the white people, why he hadn't fought back. My mother had given me a ringing slap. Fear had made her do it. And I felt that it was the fear of their enemies that made communists, unconsciously compensating for their fear, fight one another so doggedly and persistently. But I didn't tell them that. They wouldn't have understood. "Look, Ross is a minor street agitator. Forget him. And in 2 weeks he'll be no issue at all." "We're going to make an example out of Ross," they told me. "His trial will be an education for the working class, and for you too if you'll come." As they talked, my old love of witnessing something new came over me. I wanted to see this trial, but I didn't want to risk being placed on trial myself. "Listen," I told them, "I'm not guilty of Nielsen's charges. If I showed up at this trial, it would seem that I am." "No, it won't. Please, come." "All right, but listen. If I'm tricked, I'll fight you here. I don't trust Nielsen. I'm not a politician, and I cannot anticipate all the funny moves of a man who spends his waking hours plotting. Ross's trial took place that following Sunday afternoon. Comrade stood inconspicuously on guard about the meeting hall, at the doors, down the street, and along the hallways. When I appeared, I was ushered in quickly. I was tense. It was a rule that once you had entered a meeting of this kind, you could not leave until the meeting was over. It was feared that you might go to the police and denounce them all. Acting upon the loftiest of impulses, filled with love for those who suffer, urged toward fellowship with the rebellious, committed to sacrifice, why was it that there existed among communists so much hate, suspicion, bitterness, and internecine strife? I stood in the midst of people I loved, and I was afraid of them. I felt profoundly that they were traveling in the right direction. Yet if their having power to rule had depended merely upon my lifting my right hand, I would have been afraid to do so. My heart throbbed, and I whispered to myself, God, I love these people, but I'm glad that they're not in power or they'd shoot me. No one spoke to me. Some of the party leaders shot me hostile glances and looked away. Why had I been called in to witness his trial? I sat with jumpy nerves, impatient for the trial to get underway. Despite my fear, I was keenly curious. But I was determined not to participate in any way, for that would have surely, by implication, incriminated me in a network of guilt which I didn't share. Ross, the accused, sat alone at a table, in the front of the hall, his face distraught. I felt sorry for him, yet I couldn't escape feeling that he enjoyed this. For him, this was perhaps the highlight of an otherwise bleak existence. I was for these people. Being a Negro, I couldn't help it. They didn't hate Negroes. They had no racial prejudices. Many of the white men in the hall were married to Negro women, and many of the Negro men were married to white women. Jews, Germans, Russians, Spaniards, all races and nationalities were represented without any distinctions whatever. Racial hate had been the bane of my life, and here, before my eyes, was concrete proof that it could be abolished. Yet a new hate had come to take the place of the rankling racial hate. It was irrational that communists should hate what they called intellectuals or anybody who tried to think for themselves. I had fled men who didn't like the color of my skin, and now I was among men who didn't like the tone of my thoughts. In trying to grasp why communists hated intellectuals, my mind was led back again to the accounts I had read of the Russian Revolution. There had existed in old Russia millions of poor, ignorant people who were exploited by a few educated, arrogant noblemen, and it became natural for the Russian communists to associate betrayal with intellectualism. But there existed in the Western world an element that baffled and frightened the Communist Party, the prevalence of self-achieved literacy. Even a Negro, entrapped by ignorance and exploitation, as I had been, could, if he had the will and the love for it, learn to read and understand the world in which he lived. And it was these people that the communists couldn't understand. The American communists, enjoying legality, were using the methods forged by the underground Russian Bolshevik fire, and therefore had to have their followers willing to accept all explanations of reality, even when the actual situation didn't call for it. The heritage of free thought, which no man could escape if he read at all, the spirit of the Protestant ethic, which one suckled, figuratively, with one's mother's milk, that self-generating energy that made a man feel, whether he realized it or not, that he had to work and redeem himself through his own acts, all this was forbidden, taboo. And yet, this was the essence of that cultural heritage which the Communist Party had sworn to carry forward, whole and intact, into the future. But the Communist Party didn't recognize the values that it had sworn to save when it saw them. The slightest sign of any independence of thought or feeling, even if it aided the party in its work, was enough to make one suspect, to brand one as a dangerous traitor. The trial began in a quiet, informal manner. The comrades acted like a group of neighbors sitting in judgment upon one of their kind who had stolen a chicken. Anybody could ask and get the floor. There was absolute freedom of speech. Yet the meeting had an amazingly formal structure of its own, a structure that went as deep as the desire of men to live together. A member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party rose and gave a description of the world situation. He spoke without emotion and piled up hard facts. He painted a horrible but masterful picture of fascism's aggression in Germany, Italy, and Japan. I accepted the reason why the trial began in this manner. It was imperative that there be postulated against what or whom Ross's crimes had been committed. Therefore, there had to be established in the minds of all present a vivid picture of mankind under oppression. And it was a true picture. Perhaps no organization on earth, save the Communist Party, possessed so detailed a knowledge of how workers lived, for its sources of information stemmed directly from the workers themselves. The next speaker discussed the role of the Soviet Union as the world's lone workers' state, how the Soviet Union was hemmed in by enemies, how the Soviet Union was trying to industrialize itself, what sacrifices she was making to help the workers of the world to steer a path toward peace through the idea of collective security. The facts presented so far were as true as any facts could be in this uncertain world. Yet not one word had been said of the accused, who sat listening like any other member. The time had not yet come to include him and his crimes in this picture of global struggle. An absolute had first to be established in the minds of the comrades, so that they could measure the success or failure of their deeds by it. There was no mysticism, no invoking of God, merely a passionate identification of all present with a will to right wrongs. It was a simple, elemental morality. Communism had found a moral code that could control the conduct of men. Yet it was a code that stemmed from practical living and not from the injunctions of the supernatural. Still another speaker rose and described the domestic situation in the United States and linked it with the world scene. This was done in a leisurely, painstaking manner. Yet the people in the hall were charged with passion. A sense of human destiny lived. An atmosphere of human frailty was present. Finally, a speaker came forward and spoke of Chicago's South Side, its Negro population, their sufferings and handicaps, linking all that also to the world struggle. Then still another speaker followed and described the tasks of the Communist Party on the South Side. At last, the world, the national, and the local pictures had been fused into one overwhelming drama of moral struggle, in which everybody in the hall was participating. This presentation had lasted for more than 3 hours, but it had enthroned a new sense of reality in the hearts of those present, a sense of man on earth. With the exception of the church and its myths and legends, there was no agency in the world so capable of making men feel the earth and the people upon it as the Communist Party. I knew as I watched that I was looking at the future of mankind, that this way of living would finally win out. I knew that in no other way could the emotional capacities, the passional nature of men be so deeply tapped. In no other system yet devised could man so clearly reveal his destiny on earth, a destiny to rise and grapple with the world in which he lives, to wring from it the satisfactions he feels he must have. I knew as I watched and listened that but few people understood the essence of communism, its passional dynamics. But a few knew that communism was more important than any of its individual parties, than the sum of all its tactics, strategies, theories, mistakes, and tragedies. I knew that once this system became entrenched on earth, for good or bad, it could not fail. that all Europe and her armies could not destroy the Soviet Union, that the spirit of self-sacrifice that communism engendered in men would astound the world. And these people had asked me to come and listen to another man being tried, so that I might know what was in store for me if I went wrong. I was with them. Could I not rise up and tell them? But even as I thought of it, I knew they would not be able to know when I was telling the truth. My kind of helping was something frightening to them. If I talked, I would only incriminate myself further. I had wanted to tell others what these men felt. I understood their impulses, the long years, privation, and hurt out of which they had come to communism. I knew that I didn't know as much politics as Buddy Nielsen, as the members of the Central Committee, or the members of the Communist International. Politics wasn't my game. The human heart was my game. But it was only in the realm of politics that I could see the depths of the human heart. I had wanted to make others see what was in the communist heart, what the communists were after. But I was on trial by proxy, condemned by them. Toward evening, the direct charges against Ross were made, not by the leaders of the party, but by Ross's friends, those who knew him best. It was crushing. Ross wilted. His emotions couldn't withstand the weight of the moral pressure. No one was terrorized into giving information against him. They gave it willingly, citing dates, conversations, scenes. The black mass of Ross's wrongdoing emerged slowly and irrefutably. He couldn't deny it. No one could. They didn't place me on trial because they didn't know how to give names to what they feared in me. I had not fought them as Ross had. I hadn't challenged a single policy of theirs. It was my way of thinking and feeling that they feared. The conditions under which I had to work were what baffled them. Writing had to be done in loneliness, and communism had declared war upon human loneliness. Alone, they said, a man was weak. United with others, he was strong. Therefore, they habitually feared a man who stood alone. Communism spelt the unity of human life, and when a communist, newly risen from his oppressed isolation and feeling strange and lonely because of it, saw another man seeking seclusion, he became afraid of him. The communism I looked upon was impatient of extended processes, of results that couldn't be obtained overnight, of an act that couldn't be performed within a day. This was how America had embraced communism. This was America's first green fruit of materialistic rebellion. The moment came for Ross to defend himself. I had been told that he had arranged for friends of his to testify in his behalf, but he called upon no one. He stood trembling. He tried to talk, and his words wouldn't come. The hall was as still as death. Guilt was written in every pore of his black skin. His hands shook. He held onto the edge of the table to keep on his feet. His personality, his sense of himself, had been obliterated. Yet he couldn't have been so humbled unless he had shared and accepted the vision that had crushed him, the common vision that bound us all together. "Comrades," he said in a low, charged voice, "I'm guilty of all the charges, all of them." His voice broke in a sob. No one prodded him. No one tortured him. No one threatened him. He was free to go out of the hall and never see another communist, but he didn't want to. He couldn't. The vision of a communal world had sunk down into his soul, and it would never leave him until life left him. He talked on, outlining how he had erred, how he would reform. I knew as I sat there that there were many people who thought they knew life, who had been skeptical of the Moscow trials. But they couldn't have been skeptical had they witnessed this astonishing trial. Ross had not been doped. He had been awakened. It was not a fear of the Communist Party that had made him confess, but a fear of the punishment that he would exact of himself that made him tell of his wrongdoings. The Communists had talked to him until they had given him new eyes with which to see his own crime. And then they sat back and listened to him tell how he had erred. He was one with all the members there, regardless of race or color. His heart was theirs, and their hearts were his. And when a man reaches that state of kinship with others, that degree of oneness, or when a trial has made him kin, after he has been sundered from them by wrongdoing, then he must rise and say, out of a sense of the deepest morality in the world, I'm guilty. Forgive me. This, to me, was a spectacle of glory. And yet, because it had condemned me, because it was blind and ignorant, I felt that it was a spectacle of horror. The blindness of their limited lives, lives truncated and impoverished by the oppression they had suffered long before they had ever heard of communism, made them think that I was with their enemies. American life had so corrupted their consciousness that they were unable to recognize their friends when they saw them. I knew that if they had held state power, I would have been declared guilty of treason and my execution would have followed. And I knew that they felt, with all the strength of their black blindness, that they were right. I could not stay until the end. I was anxious to get out of the hall and into the streets and shake free from the gigantic tension that had hold of me. I rose and went to the door. A comrade shook his head, warning me that I couldn't leave until the trial had ended. You can't leave now, he said. I'm going out of here, I said, my anger making my voice sound louder than I intended. We glared at each other. Another comrade came running up. I stepped forward. The comrade who had rushed up gave the signal for me to be allowed to leave. They didn't want violence, and neither did I. They stepped aside. I went into the dark Chicago streets and walked home through the cold, filled with a sense of sadness. Once again, I told myself that I must learn to stand alone. I didn't feel so wounded by their rejection of me that I wanted to spend my days bleating about what they had done. Perhaps what I had already learned to feel in my childhood saved me from that futile path. I lay in bed that night and said to myself, I'll be for them, even though they are not for me. The next morning, a Negro communist came to my house before I was out of bed. He sat and wouldn't look at me. What do you want, Harold? I asked. I don't know how to say what I want to say, he said. Say it anyhow. I can stand anything now. Gee, I'm sorrier than I've ever been in my life, he cried. I didn't know what they were going to do. Do you mean that? I asked. God, yes. Thanks. I'm no enemy of the party. It was horrible, he said. There was a glimpse of glory in it, too, I said. What? Nothing, I said. He left. He was the only communist who had enough courage to speak to me. Chapter 20. From the Federal Experimental Theater, I was transferred to the Federal Writers Project, and I tried to earn my bread by writing guidebooks. Many of the writers on the project were members of the Communist Party, and they kept their revolutionary vows that restrained them from speaking to traitors of the working class. I sat beside them in the office, ate next to them in restaurants, and rode up and down in the elevators with them. But they always looked straight ahead, wordlessly. After working on the project for a few months, I was made acting supervisor of SAs, and straight away I ran into political difficulties. One morning, the administrator of the project called me into his office. Right? Who are your friends on this project? He asked. I don't know, I said. Why? Well, you ought to find out soon, he said. What do you mean? Well, some people are asking for your removal on the grounds that you are incompetent, he said. Who are they? He named several of my erstwhile comrades. Yes, it had come to that. They were trying to take the bread out of my mouth, and I agreed with them too much to want to fight back. What do you propose to do about their complaints? I asked. Nothing, he said, laughing. I think I understand what's happening here. I'm not going to let them drive you off this job. I thanked him and rose to go to the door. Something in his words had not sounded right. I turned and faced him. This job, I repeated. What do you mean? You mean to say that you don't know? He asked. Know what? What are you talking about? Why did you leave the Federal Negro Theater? I had trouble there. They drove me off the job. The Negroes did. And you don't think that they had any encouragement? He asked me ironically. I sat again. This was deadly. I gaped at him. You needn't fear here, he said. You work, right? It's hard to believe that, I murmured. Forget it, he said. I returned to my desk and stared at the communists who sat near me. I wasn't angry. I was sorry. How far can they go acting like this, I wondered. I knew that if they had succeeded in getting me fired, they would have considered it a triumph of proletarian tactics. Why could they not forget me? I was opposing no policy of theirs. I was not speaking or writing against them. But the worst was yet to come. One day at noon, I closed my desk and went down in the elevator. When I reached the first floor of the building, I saw a picket line moving to and fro in the streets. Many of the men and women carrying placards were old friends of mine, and they were chanting for higher wages for Works Progress Administration artists and writers. It wasn't the kind of picket line that one was not supposed to cross, and as I started away from the door, I heard my name shouted. There's Wright, that goddamn Trotskyite. That son of a bitch Wright is with him, too. We know you, you bastard. Wright's a traitor, too. For a moment, it seemed that I ceased to live. I'd now reached that point where I was cursed aloud in the busy streets of America's second largest city. It shook me, as nothing else had. I decided upon a bold, open, and friendly move. I had to put a stop to this hounding of me. I would go directly to the head of the local Communist Party and have it out with him, talk to him, explain things. I implored a friend of mine to use what influence he had to obtain an appointment for me with the secretary of the party. Weeks passed, and finally word came that I had an appointment, not with the secretary, but with the secretary's secretary, a girl, Alma Zetkin. I sighed and accepted it. When I walked into the headquarters of the Communist Party, I was ushered into Alma Zetkin's presence. She was plump, blonde, blue-eyed, with big braids of hair circling her head. She was shuffling a pile of papers in her hand. She didn't look up. I have an appointment to see you, I said. But I'd like to see Bernard, the party secretary. What do you want with him? She asked, not lifting her head, her eyes glued to the papers in her hand. I want to discuss my party affiliation with him, I said. He cannot see you about such matters, she said. With whom can I talk? I can listen to what you have to say, she said. She was cold, distant. I knew that she'd already made up her mind, that a decision had already been made about me. There are a lot of misunderstandings that I'd like to clear up, I said, forcing the words out of me, for I knew now that my errand was futile. What are they? She asked, still not looking at me. Quietly, I outlined the story, sticking to bare facts, feeling that I was talking to a stone wall. When I had finished, she said, We can't help you with that problem. What do you mean? If you can't get along with your comrades on the South Side, what do you expect us to do about it? She snapped, her eyes flashing blue and cold and hard. They're not people with whom one can talk, I said. I'm called a Trotskyite. Why? Are you a Trotskyite? She asked, looking at me full now. No. And why would you think I was one? I asked. She laughed silently and turned to her papers again. Well, what have you to say? I asked. There's nothing we can do for you here, she said. I stood silent for a moment. I had had my answer. Yet the answer didn't seem sensible, intelligible. I hadn't solved anything. I looked at her. She was still intent upon the papers. Goodbye, I said, turning and walking toward the door. She didn't answer. I paused at the door and stared at her again. She was still gazing at the papers. I went out. That night I tossed sleepless, trying to imagine what had been in Alma Zetkin's mind, what she had been told, what were her motives. And my mind could find nothing but improbable answers. Had she been warned that I must under no circumstances be given encouragement? If so, why? Even Ross, who had actively fought the party within the ranks of the party, was still a member in good standing. But I, whom they had officially accused of nothing, was an open enemy in their eyes. Nothing that I could think of could explain the reality I saw. My mind was like an ulcer whenever it touched upon what had happened to my relations with the party. I asked myself why a million times, and there were no answers. Days passed. I continued on my job, where I functioned as the shop chairman of the union, which I had helped to organize, though my election as shop chairman had been bitterly opposed by the party. In their efforts to nullify my influence in the union, my old comrades were willing to kill the union itself. As May Day of 1936 approached, it was voted by the union membership that we should march in the public procession. On the morning of May Day, I received printed instructions as to the time and place where our union contingent would assemble to join the parade. At noon, I hurried to the spot and found that the parade was already in progress. In vain, I searched for the banners of my union local. Where were they? I went up and down the streets, asking for the location of my local. Oh, that local's gone 15 minutes ago, a Negro told me. If you're going to march, you'd better fall in somewhere. I thanked him and walked through the milling crowds. Suddenly, I heard my name called. I turned. To my left was the Communist Party's South Side section, lined up and ready to march. Come here, an old party friend called me. I walked over to him. Aren't you marching today? He asked me. I missed my union local, I told him. What the hell, he said, march with us. I don't know, I said, remembering my last visit to the headquarters of the party and my status as an enemy. This is May Day, he said. Get into the ranks. You know the trouble I've had, I said. That's nothing, he said. Everybody's marching today. I don't think I'd better, I said, shaking my head. God damn, are you scared? He asked. This is May Day. He caught my right arm and pulled me into line beside him. I stood talking to him, asking him about his work, about common friends. Get out of our ranks, a voice barked in my ears. I turned. A white communist, a leader of the district of the Communist Party, Cy Perry, a slender, close-cropped fellow, stood glaring at me. It's May Day and I want to march, I said. Get out, he shouted. I was invited here, I said. I turned to the Negro communist who had invited me into the ranks. I didn't want public violence. I looked at my friend. He turned his eyes away. He was afraid. I didn't know what to do. You asked me to march here, I said to him. He didn't answer. "Tell him that you did invite me," I said, pulling his sleeve. "I'm asking you for the last time to get out of our ranks," Cy Perry shouted. I didn't move. I had intended to, but I was beset by so many impulses that I couldn't act. Another white communist came to assist Perry. Perry caught hold of my collar and pulled at me. I resisted. They held me fast. I struggled to free myself. "Turn me loose," I said. Hands lifted me bodily from the sidewalk. I felt myself being pitched headlong through the air. I saved myself from landing on my head by clutching a curbstone with my hands. Slowly I rose and stood. Perry and his assistant were glaring at me. The rows of white and black communists were looking at me with cold eyes of non-recognition. I couldn't quite believe what had happened, even though my hands were smarting and bleeding. I had suffered a public physical assault by two white communists, with black communists looking on. I couldn't move from the spot. I was empty of any idea about what to do. But I didn't feel belligerent. I had outgrown my childhood. I didn't know how much time elapsed as I stood there, numb, astonished, but suddenly, the vast ranks of the Communist Party began to move. Scarlet banners with the hammer and sickle emblem of world revolution were lifted, and they fluttered in the May breeze. Drums beat. Voices were chanting. The tramp of many feet shook the earth. A long line of set-faced men and women, white and black, flowed past me. I followed the procession to the loop and went into Grant Park Plaza and sat upon a bench. I was not thinking. I couldn't think. But an objectivity of vision was being born within me. A surging sweep of many odds and ends came together and formed an attitude, a perspective. "They're blind," I said to myself. "Their enemies have blinded them with too much oppression." I lit a cigarette and heard a song floating out over the sunlit air. "Arise, you prisoners of starvation." I remembered the stories I had written, the stories in which I had assigned a role of honor and glory to the Communist Party, and I was glad that they were down in black and white, were finished, for I knew in my heart that I would never be able to write that way again, would never be able to feel with that simple sharpness about life, would never again express such passionate hope, would never again make so total a commitment of faith. "Arise, you wretched of the earth!" The days of my past, of my youth, were receding from me, like a rolling tide, leaving me alone upon high, dry ground, leaving me with a quieter and deeper consciousness. "For justice thunders condemnation." My thoughts seemed to be coming from somewhere within me, as by a power of their own. "It's going to take a long and bloody time, a lot of stumbling and a lot of falling, before they find the right road. They will have to grope about blindly in the sunshine, butting their heads against every mistake, bruising their bodies against every illusion, making a million futile errors and suffering for them, bleeding for them, until they learn how to live," I thought. Somehow man had been sundered from man, and in his search for a new unity, for a new wholeness, for oneness again, he would have to blunder into a million walls to find merely that he could not go in certain directions. No one could tell him. He would have to learn by marching down history's bloody road. He would have to purchase his wisdom of life with sacred death. He would have to pay dearly to learn just a little. But perhaps that is the way it has always been with man. "A better world's in birth." The procession still passed. Banners still floated. Voices of hope still chanted. I headed toward home alone, really alone now. telling myself that in all the sprawling immensity of our mighty continent, the least known factor of living was the human heart. The least sought goal of being was a way to live a human life. Perhaps, I thought, out of my tortured feelings I could fling a spark into the darkness. I would try, not because I wanted to, but because I felt that I had to, if I were to live at all. I sat alone in my narrow room, watching the sun sink slowly in the chilly May sky. I was restless. I rose to get my hat. I wanted to visit some friends and tell them what I felt, to talk. Then I sat down. Why do that? My problem was here, here with me, here in this room, and I would solve it here, alone, or not at all. Yet I didn't want to face it. It frightened me. I rose again and went out into the streets. Halfway down the block, I stopped, undecided. Go back. I returned to my room and sat again, determined to look squarely at my life. Well, what had I got out of living in the city? What had I got out of living in the South? What had I got out of living in America? I paced the floor, knowing that all I possessed were words and dim knowledge that my country had shown me no examples of how to live a human life. All my life I had been full of a hunger for a new way to live. I heard a trolley lumbering past over steel tracks in the early dusk, and I knew that underpaid, bewildered black men and women were returning to their homes from serving their white masters. In the front room of my apartment, our radio was playing, pouring a white man's voice into my home, a voice that hinted of a coming war that would consume millions of lives. Yes, the whites were as miserable as their black victims, I thought. If this country can't find its way to a human path, if it can't inform conduct with a deep sense of life, then all of us, black as well as white, are going down the same drain. I picked up a pencil and held it over a sheet of white paper, but my feelings stood in the way of my words. Well, I would wait, day and night, until I knew what to say. Humbly now, with no vaulting dream of achieving a vast unity, I wanted to try to build a bridge of words between me and that world outside. That world which was so distant and elusive that it seemed unreal. I would hurl words into this darkness and wait for an echo. And if an echo sounded, no matter how faintly, I would send other words to tell, to march, to fight, to create a sense of the hunger for life that gnaws in us all, to keep alive in our hearts a sense of the inexpressibly human.
The End.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Cadman. To order additional cassettes or CDs, or to receive a complete catalog of Cadman and Harper Audio titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. You might also try our website, www.harperaudio.com. Thank you.